I'm Richard van der Berg.
And I'm Duncan MacLeod.
This is Talk Central, episode 177 for the weekend starting 26 May 2017.
Talk Central is brought to you by Tech Central, the home of South Africa's best technology journalism.
On Talk Central this week, government's partial U-turn on spectrum.
Also this week, Microsoft to build Azure data centers in South Africa. Naspers may sell pay TV assets. Huawei gets into the PC business. And have we hit peak TV?
Time to lift the mic stands on another podcast.
Welcome to the show. How's it, Richard?
How's it, Duncan?
Let's do the quiz. Do you want to start?
Yes, as I'm sipping my water. First question. Microsoft will build, or more accurately, co-locate two Azure data centers in South Africa. In which cities will they be located?
I forgot to mention at the start, there's an easy quiz this week.
Easy.
Second question. Huawei has launched its first laptop. What is it called?
Third question. Telecoms Minister Siyabonga Tswele this week warned that high data prices in South Africa might require the attention of which regulatory body?
Which country this week said it will drop a rape investigation against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange?
And the final question, Sony announced this week that it will discontinue which smartphone models to focus on its high-end phones.
Interesting move that by Sony. So that's our quiz. We'll get to the answers at the end of the show. We are recording on a Thursday for a change because you're off to do some video footage or something tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I'm finding a lot of these events happening over weekend. So some Fridays I'm out of the office, but tomorrow I'm actually going to Durban to go see some friends and spend some time on the beach.
Oh, right. Okay.
So hopefully shooting some drone footage on the beach.
On the beach. Okay. Good stuff. So we're recording on a Thursday, but lots of news to talk about, especially since we didn't record last Friday. So some stuff to catch up on as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
But undoubtedly the biggest news this week has been the... I think I call it a partial U-turn by the telecoms minister, Siyabonga Tswele, on spectrum. And it's positive news, not entirely positive, I think, but it is a move in the right direction. Basically, what's happened is that the government has agreed that they'll do an independent study, possibly to be done by the CSIR, possibly to be commissioned by another third party, where they will look at how much spectrum the wholesale open access network provider requires. What they said in the white paper was that all future high-demand spectrum, in other words, spectrum that can be used for mobile broadband, will be assigned to the wholesale open access network, or the WOAN, as it's called, and that none of the spectrum would be allocated to Vodacom, MTN, Cell C, Telkom, and any other prospective entrants into the market who wanted to use exclusive use spectrum, which is a model that we've used in this country historically, and it's the model that applies in just about every country in the world. So, really agreeing with the industry that there's going to be this investigation by a third-party agency to determine how much spectrum is required, the sufficient amount of spectrum that this WOAN requires. And I can almost guarantee you now that the outcome of that investigation will be that the WOAN does not need all the spectrum. In fact, I suspect that the outcome of the investigation will be that the WOAN only needs a small portion of the spectrum and that the rest can then be made available for licensing by ICASA through the normal licensing processes, be it an auction or a beauty parade contest or whichever model they prefer or a mixture of those models in the normal course of business. So your Vodacoms, your MTNs, your Cell Cs will no doubt participate in that spectrum process and will get access to the spectrum. But they have apparently agreed to, or Tswele is insisting on, is that they agree to buy 51% of the capacity of the WOAN in exchange for getting access to exclusive use spectrum, which I find, the number that was being bandied about previously was 30%. There was a proposal put on the table by the industry. It's potentially worrying because forcing them to buy 51% of this operator's capacity, if this operator is expensive, if it has, it's getting a guaranteed business here, what's to stop it from pushing up its prices? Are we going to rely on ICASA to regulate prices to ensure that it doesn't rip off the operators in the pricing? There's a lot of detail that still needs to be worked out here, but the worry is that you're creating a company that is going to have guaranteed customers, possibly written into legislation, almost certainly written into legislation. In a way, you're creating the potential for abuse because you'll have an entity with guaranteed customers. These operators have to buy capacity from this entity. What's to stop this entity from fixing prices? And at the end of the day, what will that mean? It'll mean higher prices for you and me. And the other issue is, you know, what if this WAN doesn't actually have the sort of network that the operators really need? I mean, they could make technological decisions that the other operators may decide to continue along the 3GPP path, that deploying 4G, eventually 5G networks, and the wholesale open access network provider might decide to do something completely different and choose a technology that fails. What happens then? Are the operators lumped with purchasing this technology? So there's a lot of questions that are unanswered.
It's creating a very weak point in a system that should be very resilient.
It is. Ultimately, it should be left up to the free market to decide what technologies get deployed, who buys your services from whom. What we're doing here is the government is inserting itself in the industry in a supposed attempt to improve competition in the market and allow smaller players to compete in the market, but at the end of the day maybe introducing a great deal of inefficiency into the mobile market, which could actually have the unintended consequence of leading to higher mobile prices, which would be problematic. I think the government's heart is in the right place, but I think the government has a instinctive distrust for the free market and for capitalism and the free market system generally. I mean, we know that the ANC is a left of center party. They call themselves social democrats. They believe in a mixed economy, not a free market economy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a concern that by interfering this way in the industry, an industry that's been hugely successful, by the way, you know, despite the criticism of high prices, they've been successful in rolling out mobile to most of the country. I think about 80% of South Africans own a cell phone. Mobile penetration measured by SIM cards is about 140 or 150%. So it's been a very successful industry.
It's not a result of their decisions. It's a result of market demand.
Market demand, but it's also they created the market. They rolled out the infrastructure. They made the technological decisions You know, they're the ones who decided, for example, in the early days to roll towers down the highways. I mean, Vodacom made that decision. Alan Mark Craig made that decision. MTN didn't go down the highways initially. They were forced to do that when Vodacom did it.
Yeah.
So there were, you know, largely a free market at play here. You could argue that there was too much concentration in the hands of MTN and Vodacom and that perhaps the market should have been opened up earlier. And you can, by the same token, you could also make the argument that there's a need to open up the industry to smaller players and to black-owned players to broaden the industry participation and the diversity in the industry. And, you know, I think all of those things are correct. The question is how you do it. And, you know, the risk here, I think, is that you're introducing potentially inefficiency in the industry. And what you're also potentially doing is you're going to be basically setting up a guaranteed flow of money to who? To small businesses or to the big guys who are already rich who are going to invest in this way? And I mean, two of the people who are most interested in participating in this wholesale open access network are Irene Charnley, who made an absolute fortune, very rich woman who made an absolute fortune out of MTN in her days at MTN. She now runs Smile Communications. And Andile Ngcaba, who, of course, is also incredibly wealthy and got very wealthy through a dodgy deal with Telkom back in the day, the Elephant Consortium. I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember the details behind that. But these are two of the players in the space. I think they're both billionaires. Are we just creating a situation where we're going to enrich existing rich people? That's another thing I think that needs interrogation through this whole process.
Yeah, and it's certainly not. We've been down this road before in other government departments and other business setups. So I think we have to be very cautious about how we proceed with this and make sure that the right checks and balances are in place.
Exactly, and I think the government is right when they say that there is a need to. They said there's a need to get more players into this industry. And certainly, I think we've seen that in the ISP market, especially with fixed-line broadband, how intense the competition has been there. We've seen it in ADSL. We're seeing it now in fiber. There's dozens and dozens of ISPs that are competing head-on in that market. The real costs in ADSL, for example, are not so much the ISP costs. They're the infrastructure costs, the telecom component of it, which is kept artificially high because they own the fiber and they own certainly the copper. I think in the fiber market they're facing more competition. But you know, there's an argument that if you can get a spectrum in the hands of these ISPs, that they could really have a big impact on data prices and pricing in South Africa. But again, you know, you're going to have a single point here, the WAN, But maybe the WoWAN by offering wholesale services almost like an ADSL IPC type model or something similar, maybe it'll force the other operators, Vodacom, MTN, etc., to be much more open their networks in the same way that Telkom has, and then maybe that through that process will drive down prices. So I don't think everything's negative in what's coming out here, and I think the moves we've seen this week by the minister, they certainly haven't been couched as a U-turn, but they are a U-turn. I think they're positive, but I think there's still a lot of the devil is in the detail, there's still a risk that this whole thing's going to go to court. But perhaps because of what happened this week, the chances of this getting dragged out into court have been lessened, which is a positive development. Mm. But I think kudos to Siyabonga Kwele for being prepared to amend his position. Certainly the government's not pitching this as a U-turn. But it is. They've conceded. Mm. And I think that's a positive thing because the industry has conceded as well. I mean, the industry has been very quick to actually come up with this so-called hybrid model. They didn't immediately say, oh, let's all go to court. They said, let's sit around a table and try and work something out. And they've actually made a number of very big concessions. So it appears that both sides are talking to each other, both sides are making concessions, and I suppose that is the way you actually reach a settlement at the end of the day. But I think it's incumbent upon technology journalists, analysts, commentators in the space to ask the hard questions about, well, what does this actually mean for consumers? Because it's not entirely clear at this point that it's all going to be good for consumers, especially if we're creating a situation where there's an inefficient player in the industry where the mobile operators are forced through legislation to purchase from that entity. It creates a point of friction in the market potentially. Let's hope it all just works. I mean, let's hope it is a fantastic success. But certainly in Rwanda, I was chatting to a telecoms executive. I won't say who because it was an off-the-record discussion. But I was chatting to a telecoms executive the other evening who said that the WoWAN model, which was deployed in Rwanda, has been a spectacular failure. They came in, they were the only operator with a 4G license in that country, and their prices were so much higher than the 3G data networks of the competitors in that market that no one used it, and it was a flop, and so they're revisiting the whole model. So we certainly need to avoid the Rwandan model, and certainly the minister has repeatedly said the Rwandan model is one we should follow. He's also said the Mexican model is one we should follow, and the Mexicans are desperately backtracking on their plans in that regard. Let's hope this some sense comes out of this. But I think this decision to have a study of the spectrum and what the WoWAN actually needs, not what the politicians think that WoWAN needs, is a very positive development. And hopefully we'll have the result of that in the next few months. And hopefully flowing from that, we'll see some further positive decisions made around spectrum. Because it is such an important issue.
And very sensitive too. I mean, it could have massive repercussions if it doesn't get done properly.
Exactly. Anyway, it's good that the government is dealing with these issues at last, I suppose. We still have to deal with digital migration, which is now, what year is we in now? 2017, which is now 6 years beyond the original deadline that was set by the Minister Ivy Matsepe-Kasaburi. I think she set that deadline all the way back in 2001, or she started the digital migration project back in 2001. So we're 16 years past that now, and digital TV still isn't generally available. That project needs to get sorted out. Doesn't help the Department of Communications. It's now separate from the Department of Telecommunications, which was another really stupid decision when Zuma split his cabinet after the last general election. It's caused all sorts of issues. ICASA, of course, now reports to the Department of Communications, yet the Department of Telecommunications needs to work regularly with the regulator. The regulator and the Department of Telecommunications are now in court over spectrum. Mm. It's a big mess. But things are moving forward, I think, at last. And we have a new Minister of Communications, Ayanda Dlodlo, who does seem to be more effective than her predecessor, Faith Matambi. I think she's made a mistake in going for encryption in digital broadcasts. I know that view is not universally shared. In fact, I think I may be in the minority view on encryption, but I do think she's made a mistake there. But at the end of the day, digital TV, terrestrial broadcasting, is going to be irrelevant in 10 years' time anyway, so maybe we don't care.
No, it's kind of that sliding scale. Like the better the broadband, the more people are going to be switching over to streaming services.
Yeah.
I mean, we know most people with a relatively good income, middle class to upper end LSM, most of them are switched over to streaming services. Mm. So it's just they're going to filter down.
Mm, indeed. It will eventually. I suppose the worry is that, and the concern is that, you know, if you're locking consumers into a set-top box because you've got encryption in the signal, that it's ultimately going to hurt the poor the most because they're the ones who have to have the set-top box.
It's more expense for them to get the technology. I completely agree with you.
Yeah, although the government does provide the set-top boxes for free, I suppose you could argue.
But somebody's still paying for them. At the end of the day, taxpayers' money. Is it the cost that we really need to incur?
Yeah, all good questions. Anyway, we could carry on talking through this entire podcast about these issues, but there's lots of other news to talk about. And the other big news, it wasn't this week, it was last week now, but a significant development, I think.
Yeah.
Fantastic news for the South African ICT market. And that's that Microsoft is going to deploy 2 Azure data centers in South Africa, one in Cape Town and one in Johannesburg. Now, these are going to be co-located data centers. That means they're not going to actually put up buildings themselves, which is a good thing because it means that these data centers are going to get you sooner rather than later. They don't have to go through the long, tedious process of identifying sites, putting up data centers, that sort of thing. They're going to rent space in existing facilities. And certainly we know there are plenty of data centers that have been built around this town in the last couple of years.
We've got the capacity now, so we may as well.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
So Azure data centers coming to South Africa. They're the first in Africa. I must say the Azure data center map on the Microsoft website is looking a lot better now that Africa's been lit up. They should go live in about a year's time. So Microsoft is now going to go through the process of sourcing hardware and actually building these data centers, no doubt sending engineers out here to assist the Microsoft office locally to do this.
They can build the servers, not the data centers.
The servers inside the data centers, So my understanding is they literally lease space in a data center, empty space in a data center, and then they populate that space. They haven't said who's going to be hosting these data centers for them. You know, Teraco seems like the obvious one, but I don't know if it is them. Certainly, there is a lot of data center capacity around. I was very interested that in the media release that was issued, they specifically quoted the CIO of Standard Bank, and that got me thinking that Standard Bank has a very large data center just north of Midrand, which they controversially spent a huge amount of money on, and which I understand is has a lot of vacant space in it.
So
I'm putting two and two. It's just guesswork on my part here, but I have a feeling that they may be building this inside the Standard Bank.
That's Standard Bank's own data center.
Standard Bank's own data center. So you know it's secure. It meets all these international specifications for data centers. I forget which tier it is. It's tier 3 or tier 5 or one of those. I forget what the tiering grading system is. But it's a top-class data center, which they controversially spent a lot of money on. Standard Bank is quoted in the media release saying, fantastic that they're coming to South Africa. I'm kind of putting two and two together that it's hosted in the Standard Bank data center. Might be wrong, but I suspect I'm
I would put a bet on that, yeah, definitely.
I understand that the Cape Town data center is operated by someone else, though, so which makes sense because I don't believe there is a Standard Bank data center in Cape Town. It also makes sense because, you know, in terms of resilience.
Yeah, failover and that kind of thing, having it two different.
Yeah. So, you know, if I was going to guess Cape Town, I'd probably guess Teraco in Cape Town. Standard Bank in Gauteng and Teraco in Cape Town would make sense to me. I'm sure the details will come out at some point. Pretty much like we know that Google has hosted a lot of its cloud infrastructure inside Internet Solutions data centers. It's an open secret in the market that no one actually confirms it. The other exciting thing about this Azure data center, or these Azure data centers that are going to be built here, is what it means for the competition. Now, I had a very good, interesting podcast discussion with John Tullett, who I'm sure you know well, Recha. Mm. He's now working at IDC, International Data Corp. And he said that this is very positive for potential further investment by other cloud providers. And he said that the big gorilla in the space, which of course is Amazon Web Services, could very well follow.
Well, we've been speculating that for a while, you and I.
We have.
And we've seen it with kind of any of these big services or servers coming to the country. It just takes one to crack the seal, and then the others follow.
Yeah, and I'm, you can be sure that Amazon has taken note of the fact that Microsoft is coming here.
But I'm sure they've had plans, because they've been recruiting developers for quite a long time. Locally.
Local AWS was in part built by South Africans. Mm. I think it was William van Bullion who was involved in that. Is that his name? He's now Takealot as co-CEO. He was instrumental in those early days of Amazon Web Services, and a lot of the early dev work for Amazon Web Services was done in Cape Town. Mm. Jeff Bezos knows this market, with Microsoft coming here, I'm sure he's taken note. I'm sure Amazon Web Services team has taken note. And there is, of course, the speculation about who is going to be going into the new Bredell data center that Teraco is building. Absolutely massive new data center.
Where is that?
Bredell on the East Rand.
Oh, in Bredell.
Bredell, okay. Yeah. Bredell. It's sort of semi-rural.
Never heard of that before.
Semi-rural area near the airport, on the other side of the airport. And it's not far from their existing data center, which is in Isando. I think it's a bit further east or a bit further northeast. Kind of on the other side of Kempton Park, I think.
Okay.
How you describe Bredell.
Also makes sense for packages coming in from overseas to have a warehouse close by.
To the airport.
I'm just teasing.
No.
Amazon. But a question I have about the Azure data center, I mean, what will we see as consumers, what benefit will we see? I mean, obviously game servers, Microsoft game servers could potentially, Office 365, I mean, these are all things that would now have a local platform.
Well, go have a listen to the podcast I did with John, because he goes into a lot of this detail, but he said that the impact on consumers is not really going to be that big.
Okay.
We may see better speeds connecting to OneDrive or a bit of better latency, So OneDrive should improve.
That would be a big help. I mean, that's a very popular service.
It is indeed. But this is mainly, the main benefit of this is going to be for big companies who are looking to do to put their internal services in the cloud. Most of them work for a hybrid type of cloud solution, so some on-premise, some off-premise in the data center. But clearly this is aimed at the business market. It's not really aimed at consumers. There'll be some spin-off in that, your files will be probably located on a server just down the road, connected directly with fiber.
Yeah.
So, you'll be able to, your speeds for uploading, downloading files will probably be a lot better. I've been a bit disappointed, I must say, in OneDrive's performance relative to Google Drive. It's a bit slower. It's noticeably slow. If I upload a file onto OneDrive, it takes about three times longer than it does to Google Drive. And I'm presuming that's got to do with Google being hosted locally.
OneDrive
not being locally. But you would have thought that Microsoft would have put in better measures through, using technologies like Akamai and stuff to make it more seamless and make the local performance better than it is.
I think part of OneDrive's big problem is its syncing technology. It's not as fluent. I mean, I'm a massive Dropbox user. I've got everything on there. And if I look at the amount of, I probably do a few gigabytes a day of data that transfers to my Dropbox account just on working files. And the speed is so much faster than I could ever work with in terms of syncing capability on the OneDrive. And I think it's partly to do not just with the internet speed capacity, but the technology they use. It's not as seamless.
Interesting.
Using multiple people on the same files.
I'd love to get a technical explanation for that. I mean, as you know, I dumped this podcast onto Google Drive after we've recorded, and it always goes up at 100 megs a second across fiber. If I do the same thing on OneDrive, it's about a third of that speed. The reason I use OneDrive is that I have an Office 365 subscription, and it comes with a terabyte of OneDrive storage.
Yeah, it's a lot of space.
It's fantastic, and I don't want to actually spend another $10. An extra $10 a month on Dropbox just to have cloud storage when I have cloud storage through Microsoft.
But Dropbox is so good.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan. If I need to upload something quickly into the cloud, I'll use Google Drive because I've got, I think, 300 gigabytes on Google Drive, and I'll just drop the stuff there.
Yeah,
so I don't really need to spend the extra money on Dropbox. But You know, if my ideal solution will be for OneDrive performance to improve, then I'll probably use it exclusively because it's integrated with my OS. I use Windows, I've got a terabyte of storage on there, yeah. Which I probably never use.
Virtually free.
Virtually free with my office subscription, which is about $1,100 bucks a year. Seems like a good deal to me.
Oh yeah.
So quite exciting. No doubt more details will emerge in the months ahead as we start to look at, as the build starts to happen and we start to get some details of exactly what it's going to look like. I suspect Microsoft won't be fully open about exactly what this data center is going to look like. I don't know if we'll ever actually officially know where it's hosted, although I'm sure people will figure it out and the market will talk. And
we'll trace those IPs.
Yeah, but great news. Well done, Microsoft, and let it be heard in the Amazon head office as well. We need to take a break. We'll be back right after this.
Honey, why can't I download any more series?
Dad, my game just bombed.
Daddy, I was speaking to Kevin and my call just cut out.
With uncapped Vox fiber to the home, reaching your cap is a thing of the past. You can have all your devices connected all the time. Get unlimited browsing, unlimited calling, and unlimited entertainment. Vox Fiber. Now uncapped. T's and C's apply. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Welcome back to the show. How's it, Richard?
How's it, Duncan?
So I thought this snippet of news, I don't want to talk about it too long, but Huawei, big smartphone manufacturer, yep. Big in the telecommunications space. They do a lot of telecoms work for the mobile operators, deploying towers. They do fiber. They do just about everything in that space. But known in the consumer market for their wireless dongles and their smartphones, they're getting into the PC business. Do they know something we don't?
Well, I mean, I saw this and I was thinking, that is actually a good idea. You know, you've kind of already built a really good brand for yourself. Mm. I mean, we use Huawei routers. I mean, who would have thought a few years ago you'd use a brand that you've never heard of, you know? But their phones have proved themselves worthy. Their hardware...
Their phones are great, actually.
Yeah, their hardware is good quality. I think there's always going to be a gap in the PC market. You know, laptops is obviously where it's at.
Yeah.
For a company who's into electronics, make cell phones, the PC should be much easier piece of hardware to manufacture.
Yes.
And obviously a lot easier to get hold of those components. I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
I think
it looks like an
Apple
machine.
Apple's going to have a run for their money. That's going to prove their worth in the future.
It looks a lot like a MacBook, I must say.
It does.
Yeah, it's called the MateBook.
MateBook.
The name is even similar.
Wonder where that came from.
The MateBook X. It's a sexy-looking machine. But laptops, I think especially when you're not looking at the very top end, laptops are these ultra-thin laptops are actually basically tablets with keyboards attached.
Yeah. I mean, the components on the inside, everything is basically a single motherboard these days, except for the battery that you slot in. And
It doesn't even have a fan in it, so... Yeah. They are becoming like, it's like a smartphone with a keyboard or a tablet with a keyboard. That's the way we're heading.
And from a pricing point of view, I think they're going to force, if they come in with good pricing.
They
like
will,
I
and you know they will.
They're going to shake it up a bit and make sure that the other guys, come down in pricing with equally good hardware.
Yeah. No word yet on whether they're coming to South Africa, but hopefully they will at some point. And I think if they're priced correctly that there'll be demand here in the local market. And maybe they're getting into this market at the right time. You know, the PC market has been in decline for a number of years now, and I think smartphones have had, and tablets for that matter, but primarily smartphones. And as we've moved to larger screen smartphones, I think it's had an impact on that PC market, especially in the consumer space.
Oh yeah.
But we saw results out from Lenovo yesterday, and they're looking reasonably positive. Actually, they beat analyst forecasts on the fact that there's been no further slowdown in the PC sales. So it looks like maybe the corner is starting to turn the corner in that market. So maybe it's the right time to get in. Maybe there's going to be a bit of an uptick over the next couple of years in PCs. And, you know, the PC market, you know, everyone's very negative and bearish on it, but it's not going to go away. I mean, the PC is a form factor that is still hugely important. I mean, corporates aren't going to ditch the PC. I mean, you can imagine some consumers... not needing a PC, especially with the advent of tablets. In the past you'd want a computer at home so you could do your banking and that sort of thing, but you can do that all on your phone now. So arguably in the consumer market, it's not necessary, although In the tech geeky space, I mean, we have to have a PC.
Oh, yeah. Right? I mean, keyboard and screen combination, yeah. You know, there's a reason why it falls down like that and the shape is like that.
Yeah.
It's been proven, you know, it works. I think the only long-term competition or obstacle that PCs might have is augmented reality. Now, when that technology matures and you have your glasses with built-in screen, any surface can be your screen.
Mm.
You'll just need an input device. But that's still a few years away. We're not going to see the decline of the notebook anytime soon.
Quite a few years away, and I think there's still a big question mark over whether people want that as their computing interface.
Yeah, but I guess you can argue, but the technology will catch up eventually. I mean, you'll have full 20K, whatever the resolution may be at the time.
Yeah.
You know, being able to project it onto a contact lens.
I mean,
we've got the technology already. Mm. It's just a matter of adoption.
I must say, I'm much more excited about the voice as an interface. I think voice is... it has got much more potential, especially in the short term. I was amazed to hear a stat the other day. I'm afraid I've forgotten who said it, but apparently 1/3 of all Google searches now are done by voice.
That is interesting.
That is huge.
I don't use it at all. I mean, the odd moment in the car when I need something.
Yeah. I actually use it all the time. I'm sitting on the couch. I just talk to Google. I couldn't be bothered to type on that keyboard. It's so good. I mean, it almost never makes a mistake now. And I can have the music blaring in the background. I can still have a conversation, and it picks it up.
Very interesting. I must look into it and start playing with it.
Yeah, no, it's really improved dramatically and noticeably in the last year.
But gesture control and audio control is something that I'm seeing a lot more in technology all around, you know, from action cameras to drones, you know, these things can be controlled with gesture and with voice.
Mm.
So just it kind of reinforces what you're saying, and I didn't think of it in those terms. Very interesting.
But I think the potential of voice is massive. I mean, imagine in the future you fire up your banking app on your phone, for example. You don't even have to fire up the app. You could just have a conversation with your phone. You could say, hey, F&B, transfer 5,000 rand from my credit card to my check card.
As long as it doesn't ask for your PIN number. My PIN number is 1234.
Yes. Well, your security could be your voice. I mean, your voice print.
Yes, exactly.
Or, you probably won't use that because it probably needs some sort of two-factor authentication. So it'll probably say, oh, please scan your fingerprint on the back.
Mm-hmm.
We've checked your voice. Your voice matches. Now please scan your fingerprint, and then we'll do the transfer.
You're not under duress. Our algorithms pick up that nobody's standing behind you.
Yes.
You're accepted again.
But voice is, I think that these things like the Amazon Echo, the Google Home, I really wish one of them would come to South Africa officially, because I really want one in my house. Those devices have once the artificial intelligence behind those really improves, and we're seeing massive investments and massive advances in AI technology happening. You'll just sit on your couch. Your Echo will be sitting on the table, or the technology will be built into your phone or your TV or whatever device it happens to be, and you'll just say, "Hey, please deliver me two large ham and pineapple pizzas from Pizza Perfect."
Yeah,
and it'll say back to you, "No problem. That'll be 139 rand. Would you like to debit your credit card?" Yeah, sure. Please go ahead. 10 minutes later, ding ding, here's your pizza.
And then with your wireless doorbell, you can see who it is. Let him in remotely. I mean, we're living in the future.
Yeah, you can open the door and the robot will be there with your pizzas.
But isn't this another reason why?
Well, the drone will come in through the window.
Yeah, I just drop it off in your hand. But isn't that another reason why these data centers are so important? Because without an Amazon data center, we're not going to get an Echo. They just need to load the code on the local server so that we can get that. The transfer of information much quicker.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they haven't expanded the Echo more aggressively worldwide than they have. It's available in very few markets, actually. Mm. I think Britain, they just recently launched
in the UK,
and one or two other markets in the US. I think Germany was one of the launch markets as well, the new rollout. But most markets still don't have the Echo.
I think they're trying to prevent it's such a new technology, and I think there's so much with speech patterns, accent, dialect, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
I think they're being cautious rather than, they've been burnt with their previous products. You know, what was that tablet that they launched that failed dismally?
The Fire.
Mm.
The Kindle Fire.
I think it's the Kindle Fire. I think it's just a calculated rollout plan, and I would rather see a mature product in South Africa than something that doesn't work. So
yeah.
I'm all for it.
Okay. Yeah, I wonder who will come here first, Google Home or the Amazon Echo.
Now that's an interesting question. Yeah, I guess it'll depend on who's got the data center up first.
Look, Google still really has capacity here. I don't know to what extent that, I don't think it's the hardcore business services that the Microsoft facilities are going to be offering. I think it's more just to host. local storage and services, but I don't think it's I don't think it's the sort of intensive business services that Microsoft's planning to offer. I don't think Google really is a big player in that space. It's really dominated by Amazon, and Microsoft is a strong second player. It's exciting times, actually, and it's great to see these big tech giants looking at this market. Interesting piece on Bloomberg over the last week suggesting that Naspers may sell its pay TV assets in Africa. Interesting speculation. The talk is that MTN had a look at MultiChoice Africa and decided not to do a deal. But I guess what's more interesting out of this Bloomberg story is that Naspers is considering selling these assets at all. What does it say about Naspers' view on the future of pay television?
Television period, I guess.
Oh, but they're fully invested in television. I mean, they're going full on with Showmax.
Sorry, terrestrial television.
Terrestrial. Well, this is satellite pay TV. I think it probably says more about the African market than it does about anything else. They've specifically stated that, the article said that they're not interested in selling their South African pay TV asset. This is MultiChoice Africa, it's a business outside of Africa, which I think is a very different kettle of fish to DStv here in South Africa. They've got a very dominant, strong position with DStv in South Africa, very profitable. I think outside South Africa, it's a different market. The consumer is not nearly as wealthy as the average South African DStv consumer. And so it's a different proposition elsewhere in Africa. I think much more of a prepaid type of proposition. And I think that they're facing significantly more competition outside of South Africa from other players like Star Times, the Chinese pay TV provider, and there are others. Econet, StriveMasi, US company, is also making big moves into the pay TV market, both terrestrially and in satellite. Particularly the Chinese guys are looking at that. MultiChoice's assets outside the country include DStv and GoTV, which is their digital terrestrial television platform, which I think has been enjoying some success in some of the markets that they've gone into. The rest of Africa is much more competitive. Maybe it makes sense to offload those assets to someone else. I'd imagine the Chinese would be interested. I'd imagine, MTN has clearly had a look. It appears they've said no. There are other potential buyers out there, maybe Econet, maybe Star Times, maybe someone else. Whether Naspers consider selling the DStv South Africa assets at some point seems less likely. I mean, that's still such a profitable business for them. I know that it's completely discounted in their market cap, which is trading at a discount to the value of their stake in Tencent in China. If you took the value, I was reading a very interesting piece by an analyst the other day. If you took just the valuation of Naspers' 33% stake in Tencent, then Naspers' share price should be trading at about 3,300 rand a share, but it's actually trading at about 2,800 rand a share. So it's trading at a discount to the value of its 33% stake in Tencent, and so the market hasn't even priced in DStv MultiChoice any value in that business, which is really interesting. Why such a massive discount to the value of their investment in Tencent? So they've got this pay TV asset in South Africa, but it's not reflected in the share price, even though it's a huge business, very profitable, dominates its space. I can't see them selling it. I don't think it makes sense at this time.
Yeah.
Eventually, I think the pressure is really going to come onto that business where streaming really starts to take off. I don't think that's going to happen right now. I think very few people have cancelled their DStv subscriptions yet because of streaming. It is happening. We know anecdotally, we both know people who've done it. But I think the broader market hasn't done that yet. Particularly if you're a sports lover, you don't really have an option except to subscribe to DStv Premium, particularly if you want to watch rugby. It's an interesting one. But the market is fluid. The market is changing. That a company like Naspers is even considering selling some of its pay TV assets, albeit outside of South Africa, perhaps suggests that the internet is really starting to change that market. It's probably more though to do with the level of competition it faces in the rest of Africa, and also just how to turn, make that a really profitable business. But yeah, South Africa, I honestly can't see them offloading that business for a number of years still.
Yeah, I agree.
So related to that was a very interesting piece we picked up from Bloomberg and ran on Tech Central this week with the headline, "Have We Hit Peak TV?" Something I've actually been wondering about as a streaming consumer. I can't keep up with all the great shows anymore.
There's
just so much. The Bloomberg piece made the point that it was AMC Networks, the company behind Mad Men and The Walking Dead and, of course, the fantastic Breaking Bad, that really started this move towards the scripted programming, serialization of television shows. You recall before that reality TV was really, really big. It's still big, but it's but there's a real rise of scripted programming, and we've seen fantastic shows. And it's really been actually a lot of the streaming providers have really driven this. Netflix in particular, we've seen with great shows like House of Cards and Narcos, fantastic TV show. And we're spoiled for choice now. I actually cannot keep up with all the great shows that are coming out on Netflix at the moment. Just on Netflix, I can't keep up.
No, it's incredible. I mean, for me, it actually started back when Lost. I don't even remember Lost when that came out. To me, that was the first time I thought.
I have a love-hate relationship with that show.
Yeah, it stopped after the second season.
It's not just season two. It just got stupid.
Yeah, but the first season was groundbreaking in so many ways. And the fact that you have something that, it also showed us that people will drag out a storyline, which is not ideal. Mm. But yeah, I guess the question is, can people consume too much media? At which point do people stop consuming that media?
Well, I think the issue is you've got so many shows now that there's a dilution of eyeballs, and these shows need a certain number of viewers to make them profitable.
Yes.
And that number's in the millions. Just in America, where they look to monetize.
That's not take into account the piracy of those shows, because a lot of people would download the torrents of the show.
Obviously they make no money from that. And increasingly, you're seeing a lot of shows appearing on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to go down. They just stay there. It raises a really interesting question. People say we're in this golden age of television. But is it sustainable? And we're seeing evidence now, according to this article we carried, that it might not be sustainable, because we're seeing these networks starting to cut back on some of that original programming, starting to shift some of the investment they'd put in that scripted programming into reality TV again, which I think is a horrible idea, but there's a big market for it. But it's fascinating to see just how television in the last 10 years has become absolutely fantastic. I used to go to the movie house a lot. I don't go to the movies anymore just because there's so much good stuff on TV.
Yeah. It's just really long movies. That's really what it comes down to, the TV show. But I think if you look at where do these things come from, stories will never fade out, so we'll always have lots of stories. I think what this is going to cause is maybe less noise, you know. You'll still have really good shows that come to the front. House of Cards is a kind of franchise, I think, is a good example of what can be done with a series-type show, and that kind of thing won't fade away. Yeah. I think you might just have less contenders or less money being spent on 20 shows. They'll probably just make less, but really good quality, and focus on the stories again.
But it's amazing that the quality of the original productions we're seeing on streaming services is fantastic. I'd say it's better than what you get through the traditional networks. I mean, I don't know if you saw Netflix's The Crown about the British royal family.
I haven't watched it, but I've seen it on Netflix.
Brilliant television. I mean, they must have invested a small fortune making that thing. House of Cards, fantastic political show. Just trying to think of something else. Amazon. I'm a subscriber to Amazon's Amazon Prime TV, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. There's a show that based on the Philip K. Dick novel called The Man in the High Castle. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant television.
I'd like to check that out.
Its proposition is the Nazis won. What happened after? When the Nazis win World War II.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It starts a bit slowly, but it really builds up a head of steam. It's a really good, really good show.
That sounds like I must go check that out, definitely.
We should actually do an occasional insert on this podcast talking about some of the shows we've seen. Because
I could talk for days about
it. Well, let's do it. Yeah, let's do maybe once for every 3 weeks. We'll have a chat about some of the shows we've been enjoying.
What's hot?
There's another one on Netflix called Boss Girl. I don't know if you've seen
it. Yes, I've just recently launched. I haven't watched that yet.
It's really good as well. It's a comedy. It's very loosely based on a true story about a woman in San Francisco who started selling fashion on eBay.
Yes.
And turned it into a multi-million-dollar startup.
Nice.
It's a fun. It's a bit below the belt, but it's a,
yeah. I don't mind. I'm a big fan of comedy like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's a good show. So tons of stuff. Yeah, let's make this a regular, maybe a monthly feature. We talk about what's happening in the world of TV.
Yeah, what's new and exciting.
Mm. Our best show of all time, though, is still Breaking Bad.
Yeah, no, I love it. Breaking Bad is up there. Not my favorite.
It's not your favorite.
But it's up there, yeah.
What is your favorite?
Now you're putting me on the spot here. House of Cards really did it for me. Yeah. I was glued to that.
I've only seen the first season. I'm still getting back to seeing the whole thing.
But I think if you look at other shows, you know, Weeds really got it for me. It's a kind of show like Friends where you don't watch it once and it's over. You always go back to it and watch episodes, and you always have context to it.
Weeds is great. I thought it lost the plot a bit towards the end, but there's a lot of American shows.
There's a lot of episodes, and they're only 20 minutes long, right? So they're kind of quick hits.
Yeah.
Friends is always a staple Friends, of mine that I put on the background. It's the kind of thing you can just put on.
Yeah, and Veep, of course, is
Veep, brilliant. And then Family Guy and South Park. I mean, those are classics. I
can't get it off. I can't believe The Simpsons is still on TV, by the way.
That's ridiculous. Eh? That's at 23 years almost.
No. And it's actually not very good anymore. I watched an episode the other night of the new season, and
I stopped but that's, you know, Family Guy and South Park are slightly different.
South Park is brilliant.
Different comedy. Mm. South Park is also getting a little bit stale now. I think that they're following a longer story arc. It's not just each episode, so now it's kind of, there's more to each,
right,
which is fine, but I think it's they used to make fun of a lot of politics. Now it's kind of less so, it seems. It's really...
I must say I haven't watched South Park in years, but I love the fact that they actually picked up contemporary issues and the news of the day. And
they still do it, but it doesn't seem as hard-hitting as it was. Maybe it's just the duration of the show overall, like The Simpsons.
Yes. I suppose you can't keep coming up with new gags all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Oh, well, Simpsons have been... There was a very good episode where in South Park where it was all about The Simpsons did it already. South Park tried to do something and The Simpsons already did it. It was hilarious. Very good crossover episodes. They've done a few of those. Even Family Guy, crossover with Simpsons. Because they're all rivals, but I think there's this friendly rivalry going
on. Oh, I'm sure there is, Yeah. So, Richard, you wanted to chat about a new drone from DJI.
DJI, yes. Now, as you know, I'm a big drone fan. I've got a Phantom 3 and shoot a lot of video with it. But this really caught my attention. It was announced a day or two ago, the DJI Spark. Now, what makes this really interesting is the fact that now you've got a drone not just the size of your phone. So, I mean, the body is roughly the size. If I hold up my iPhone 6S here, it's roughly that size. The propellers don't fold out. The propellers can fold out, but the arms kind of stay in place. But this thing can fit into your pocket. Now, it's not unlike DJI's other drones, which are aimed at a slightly higher end of the market, you know, photographers, videographers.
Yeah.
This is aimed at the consumer photographer.
Okay.
So, I mean, imagine you go out and buy your Canon PowerShot. Now, this is kind of aiming at that market. It's still going to be a little bit pricey, but you can see where the technology is going. It's the kind of thing where you take it out of your pocket, you lift it into the air, voice or gesture control, and it'll take photographs or video of you. It's obviously limited in terms of the distances and how far it can fly compared to the more pro versions of these drones. But the question that I kind of left with after seeing the launch and looking at this pretty impressive looking drone is the fact, you know, we've got all this legislation around drones coming in, really trying to prevent the airspace being flogged with unmanned aerial vehicles that could cause injury and harm. I wonder how this is going to fit into that space. I mean, this is going to allow more people to throw devices into the air that's going to stay there and hover.
Mm.
The thing's got a range of about 2 km. So, I mean, that's quite a distance. And I mean, I don't think you can cause damage with it. It's a very small device. It comes with prop guards that you can put on. I'm just going to show you a photo there. So, I mean, I guess it can be safe, and it's designed to fly around people. So, I think they... You know, and these
we'll see what happens when it gets...
The propellers will fold in when they hit you, that kind of thing, you know.
We'll see what happens when it gets sucked into the engine of a Boeing Zimbabwe.
Yeah, exactly. No, that is kind of the way where I'm going with this. With a lot of these things, a lot of places like in parks, you know, you can't go up Table Mountain and fly your drone. It's not allowed.
Yeah.
this kind of thing, where do you draw the line? I mean, this is an extension of the selfie pole, really.
Yeah.
You know, instead of putting your camera out in the pole, you now hover it maybe 2 meters from you at a height of a meter and take your photograph.
Yeah.
It's fantastic technology, and I'm really excited about this. But I am wondering where it's taking us, especially now it's becoming so much more accessible.
Yes.
And no doubt the price is going to come down.
How much is this new one?
So the price, I think, was about $500 that they said. So it's about 15, maybe 10, 11 grand. I'm just double-checking the price here.
$500, yeah.
About $8,000, yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's still not something for the entry-level market, but it's making it, again, a lot more accessible.
Mm.
It's got some limitations over the others. Like I said, image quality isn't as good. The gimbal is a two-axis gimbal as opposed to a three-axis. It still offers you a lot of stabilization. But it's going to be interesting to see where this is, because again, now the benchmark has moved slightly. Now you have a really good commercial consumer drone.
So this comes mounted with a camera?
It comes with a camera, it's built in.
Okay.
Yeah. 16 minutes flying time.
16 minutes,
yeah. Okay. It's got DJI's sonar technology built in, so it won't fly into things. It'll stop before it hits a building, which is great.
Yes.
12 megapixel camera. It can fly about 2 kilometers from you at a speed of 50 kilometers an hour. So, yeah, I can't wait to play with this, but it's going to be interesting to see what the market does with this and what governments and legislators do to prevent illegal flying or flying in places we can't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, DJI did recently update their firmware, or is going to update their firmware. Every DJI owner is going to have to register their drone using the software. And what uh-huh. speculation is that they are trying to kind of appease legislators who want these things to be controlled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
DJI has got the capability to prevent you from launching your drone if you fly it in the airport or
yes.
near a place where there's a geo fence around.
Yes.
So I think that kind of thing is going to become much tighter in terms of what the software allows you to do. And that's the only way you're going to really be able to prevent flying.
Right.
But this thing, again, moves the benchmark because you can fly it indoors
yes.
as well.
Right, right. Cool. So let's move on to our regular features. Our winner this week, I've picked NASPERS, just because of their investment in Tencent. We spoke about it a bit earlier in the podcast, but their share price has really been on a tear. Their market capitalization is now 1.21 trillion rand.
Sure.
biggest company on the JSE by market value. Not bad for a company that started out as a newspaper publisher.
Mm.
Incredibly successful, and it's all all of that is on the back of this 33% stake they bought in Tencent, I think back in 2000, 2001,
yeah.
for $33 million. That stake is now estimated to be worth about 1.5 trillion rand, and it was, of course, led by Antuni Roo, the former CEO of MWeb, who took on the responsibility of that expansion for NASPERS. He passed away quite a few years ago now. But brilliant, brilliant investment. I mean, one of the best returns in the history of an acquisition anywhere in the world.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Absolutely phenomenal. So they're our winner this week. And we racked our brains before the podcast, really tried to come up with a loser this week.
A unique loser, because we can mention a few regulars that lie floating around.
We thought we couldn't do the Eskom board 2 weeks in a row, so... we'll let them off this week. No losers this week for our in our regular features. What's your pick this week, Rafa?
So as you know, I'm a big fan of video. I edit a lot of video too. My primary program that I use is Adobe Premiere Pro.
Yeah.
But I've kind of been playing around with a few other pieces of software just to get, you know, I'm trying to expand on a little something I'm experimenting with. And I came across this one piece of software called Blackmagic DaVinci Resolve. Now, it's free video editing software that is actually pretty impressive. So if you're into putting video together or you want to start off, I would certainly recommend you checking out this piece of software. We'll put the link in the show notes. Now, Blackmagic is a very popular, is a incredibly high-end video camera manufacturer. They kind of create these high-end video cameras that movie professionals use and advert professionals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's 4K, 8K, these really top-notch stuff. Now, DaVinci Resolve the free version of the software is limited. You can't export 4K. There's some 3D limitations and some tool limitations. But for the average user who wants to cut video clips together, this is absolutely superb. Mm-hmm. And because it's free, I mean, you can't really get better than this. There are some other applications out there that does something similar. I mean, or free software alternatives. But this is one that I would want to spend my time on. I've been playing with it for about a week now. And I kind of like it. I won't move away from Premiere Pro because I've obviously got a full suite within Premiere Pro, and I'm quite used to all the tools working together. But should you wish to upgrade DaVinci Resolve, it'll only cost you $300, which is quite a lot cheaper than getting a yearly package, a Adobe Premiere Pro package.
Yeah.
Like I said, we'll put the links in the show notes, but that's my pick, and I would highly recommend it.
I'm going to download it and have a look at that. Yeah, does it run on Windows and Mac? Eh?
Windows and Mac, okay. Yeah. There's a public beta out now that I'm actually playing with, version 14, but you can get to stable version 12.5
right.
For free as well.
Okay, cool. My pick this week is an app. It's available only for Android at the moment. It's called Stash. Written ST hashtag.
Oh, that's very millennial of these guys.
I think that's the market it's aimed at. Yeah. It's developed by a very unmillennial company, Liberty, the insurance company. And it really allows you to stash your digital change, your spare change, rather. So whenever you make a purchase, they pick up that purchase and they will put your money into a savings account. So they'll round it up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I know some of the banks offer this. FNB, I know, offers a bank your change feature on their digital banking. You just need to enable it in the back end, and then it just rounds it up, and it goes into a savings pocket. So it's a similar sort of idea, except it's been implemented as an app. It's done by Liberty, and there are no fees associated with it, which is fantastic.
And you can use it with any bank?
It works with just about any bank. I think there might have been one bank that was missing. But it works with pretty much all the banks. Yeah,
I'm definitely gonna check that out.
It's called Stash. If you just search the word Stash in the Play Store, you'll find it. It's not available for iOS.
Oh, I can't get it. I was so excited. Thanks.
Come on, you must have an Android phone lying around somewhere. it's not available. But I suppose the market they're aiming at a younger market probably the market that they're aiming at is mostly on Android. I guess it makes sense to go for Android first. Perhaps there'll be an iOS app at a later date. But it's quite a cool little app. It's worth checking out. It's called Stash, and it's in the Play Store. And that, folks, as they say, is that.
Is that.
Of course, we still need to do the quiz results. So let me jump in with the first question. Microsoft will build, or more accurately, co-locate 2 Azure data centers in South Africa. In which cities will they be located? And that's Joburg and Cape Town.
The second question. Huawei has launched its first laptop. What is it called? And the answer we said, the MateBook X.
Telecoms Minister Siyabonga Ncwele this week warned that high data prices in South Africa might require the attention of which regulatory body? And that is the Competition Commission.
The fourth question. Which country this week said it will drop the rape investigation against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange? And the answer there is Sweden.
And our last question on the show this week. Sony announced this week that it will discontinue which smartphone models to focus on its high-end phones, and those are the mid-range Xperia X and Xperia X Compact.
Interesting.
Very interesting move by Sony, yeah. Makes sense, I suppose. I mean, why focus on lower-end models, when especially when you're a smaller smartphone maker, when you can perhaps focus on one or two models? And hopefully maximize your profit margin on those models.
And they've been good at the high-end stuff. I mean,
they have been.
Their products are really good.
They have been, although I think they're facing a serious challenge now from Samsung and no doubt from Apple later this year when the next iPhone comes out. I think their design styling has fallen a bit behind, but I think all the phone makers have that problem now since the S8 came out.
You can only shape a block so many ways.
Yes, indeed. That's Sony. That's our show as well. As always, if you've got any feedback, we love getting your mails. We do read all of them. Our email address is info@techcentral.co.za. Until next time, from Rechid and myself, cheers.
Ciao.